One of the world's most famous journalists had this to say about a censored press. He says it leads to hypocrisy, the greatest of all vices. And the government hears only its own voices and surrenders to the illusion that it hears the voice of the people. The people, on its side, falls either into political superstition or else into indifference, and so turns completely away from the life of the state. That sounds pretty much what's happened around here in the U.S., doesn't it? That's interesting, because the journalist was Karl Marx. I guess he'd feel pretty much at home here on Alternative Views News Magazine.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Alternative Views. Tonight's program, the centerpiece of tonight's program, is a discussion of Karl Marx and socialism today, not a topic I'm sure you're used to hearing on American television. And joining us on the panel tonight is someone from, with an experience of socialism in its practice, Sveta Stahanovic of Yugoslavia, a visiting professor here in the government department at the University of Texas, author of many books and articles on socialism, and joining on the panel, Doug Kellner, Frank Morrow, Al Slavinsky. We'll be discussing Karl Marx and socialism today. So stay tuned, but first we'll have the news as usual.
Well, Al, I think you have the biggest stories here today, so why don't you go ahead and start off.
Okay, Frank. It was reported on CBS News not too long ago that personal income rose for 1% in March. End of story. What they fail to tell you, of course, is that the top 20% of the income class, people making over $26,000 a year, get almost half of any gain in personal income. The top 40%, which includes people making roughly over $20,000 a year, get almost 70% of any gain in personal income. And by the time you get down to what most of us are making, or, you know, around $14,000, $13,000 a year.
You make that much?
Well,
wow.
Most of the average Americans, the average here is what we're talking about, Frank.
Okay.
It's up to 83% of the personal income gains. And then about a week later, they get into the inflation picture. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that people are having a difficult time associating how this gain in income can be completely wiped out by inflation. But last March, this March, actually 1979, the rate of inflation hit 1% for the month. For the year, going back to March 78, that's a gain of 10%. And if it keeps up at the same rate for the rest of this year, it'll be a gain of 13%. What they're not telling you is that inflation in the basic necessities, such as gasoline, was up almost 4% for the month. Not for the year, for the month. Food was up 2.7% for the month. Clothing was up 1.6% for the month. Housing was up 1% for the month. Now let's translate that into bucks. Willard Mueller has estimated that any 1% gain in just the food sector alone of the economy can yield $1.5 billion to the top concentrated food processors, Frank. So I'll turn it back to you.
I guess that means I got to go out and get a job, doesn't it?
Really.
Hey, you also have something on profits, do you not? Particularly the oil companies?
Right, Frank. Well, if you want, we'll do that one now.
Yeah, because I've got some nasty things also to say about the oil company.
Right, since
I set them up now.
Yeah,
I'll provide balance.
Yeah. Before I mention profits, it's interesting to note that they're closing gas stations throughout the country on Sundays. The significance of this is that when most of us who work 4, 5, 6 days a week, you know, take our Sunday outing in the countryside, the gas stations are going to be closed. They've estimated that this Sunday, which would be March 29th, that almost 100% of the gas stations in the Chicago area are going to be closed. Denver area, close to 66%, western Pennsylvania, over 50%, and Florida, 50% of the gas stations will be closed on Sunday. For those of you who pulled into the pumps recently, and here in Texas, paying 80 cents a gallon for gasoline, it's interesting to note that oil profits have never been better. First quarter of 1979. This obviously because of higher prices. Exxon's profits up 37%. Texaco. Now this is from last year, of course, and what a lot of people don't realize that profits, despite what you hear in the media press, profits were not depressed last year. Profits were very good last year. They've been very good ever since 1973. They've been good actually since 1955 or 51. But basically, Exxon's profits were up 37%. Texaco's profits were up 81%. Gulf up 61%. Standard of Indiana 28%. SoHio, Standard of Ohio, 303% increase in profits. Mobil, 82%. I wonder how much that comes from Montgomery Ward. Sun, 43%. Kerr-McGee, which produces oil, by the way, 89%. Shell, 16%. Armada Hess, 279%. Marathon, 108%. City Service and Getty Oil, both 42%. And down at the bottom, Phillips with a 4% increase for the quarter. Now, lest you feel sorry for Phillips, they still rank about 5 or 6 in profits at about $200 billion.
Yeah. Well, I noticed the Wall Street Journal just had a figure for the top 532 companies in the United States, and their profits averaged an increase of 37%. That's for all of them.
That's for the first quarter. Right.
And we have to get along with 7%, right, to be patriotic.
This is the top 500.
Well, you know, this business of Carter saying windfall profits, we're going to tax them, right? Well, this White House plan was billed as a 50% tax on added revenues that the oil companies will get after decontrol, but its own figures show that the tax won't yield more than $2.9 billion in fiscal years 1980 and 81, or just 18% of the extra $16.3 billion the industry would get in calendar year 1980 and 1981. Now, there were just a few little exemptions there that we haven't been told about. Congressional liberals are upset to learn the tax plan may exempt two-thirds of all the old oil, which will be doubled in price by decontrol.
Also, Frank, they're throwing around the idea that they might be able to deduct their windfall profits tax from their federal income tax. That's a nice little scheme.
Yeah. Well, apparently the people aren't buying it. According to a New York Times CBS poll, 50% of the people don't believe that there's a shortage. They distrust these plans for decontrol of oil, and about 56% of those people don't believe that the higher prices are going to lead to the oil companies trying to discover more oil. 3 out of 4 people think the oil companies are just out to make more money.
Well, Frank, we have a correction on that story. When Mobil bought Montgomery Ward, they did discover oil. There was oil out in the gardening section. They had cans of oil that people used for their lawnmowers and stuff, and so Mobil did add to their oil supplies when they bought Montgomery Ward.
It's a curious thing to note, back in 1974, the Ford Foundation had a energy policy project. They were trying to figure out just how much oil do we have, and potentially do we have, and they figured 200 to 400 billion barrels of oil recoverable onshore and offshore here. And of course, that's considerably more than what they have in the Middle East. In addition to this, the Ford Foundation figures were higher for natural gas even than that. 1,000 to 2,000 trillion cubic feet. That's what? What's higher than a trillion? I didn't get lost back then. Anyway, that's what it is. And the present U.S. production is only 1% of that upper figure.
It's also interesting to note that somebody out in the western states has discovered a way of processing some of the shale oil at $10 a barrel. And the estimates are now that we have something close to 400 billion barrels.
Oh, it's more than that.
Well,
it's
I've seen estimates as high as 5 trillion.
$1.8 trillion.
But there's about 400 or 500 billion barrels in easily recoverable $10 a barrel oil from shale. This guy's got a new process, and unfortunately, he went to the government for help, and the government's getting in on the project.
Oh, there was something I was going to ask you. I noticed a little old bitty story in Wall Street Journal saying that copper prices suddenly were going, and they also said that suddenly copper was disappearing in inventories around the country. Do you have any ideas about what's happening?
Just the simple fact that the oil industry has also monopolized the copper industry, not just acquisition of Kennecott Copper by one of the major oil companies, but they have a significant share of the output now in the copper industry.
Wow, I guess they're taking everything. Well, Mobil Oil, you know, they've got into, they bought Montgomery Ward, and they bought Hefty, you know, little bags you put your garbage in and other things. They're also trying now to acquire Bedcaw Company, which is mainly timberland, lignite, and just a little bit of gas.
You mean their attempts to buy General Crude Oil fell through?
I don't know.
That was close to a $1 billion acquisition. They offered International Paper almost $1 billion for General Crude Oil, which is not exactly my idea of finding new oil.
No. Well, folks, by the time we probably see this, I guess the Bilderbergers will have had their yearly meeting. This is about that time of the year. And, of course, you never hear about the Bilderbergers except from the Spotlight, the Liberty Lobby newspaper. The Bilderbergers are the group of, well, they're, if you're anybody at all in the world, you're a Bilderberger. They're the top industrialists, international bankers, multinational corporate leaders, as well as leaders from various governments around the world, and with occasional academic thrown in here and there just to come one time, maybe give a little talk. And mixed in with this, you find some of the police people like CIA, Interpol. Anyway, they've met since 1954 under extreme secrecy. Extreme secrecy. I mean, tanks, armored cars, and machine gun posts, you know. We've had a couple of spotlights on the Bilderbergers ourselves on this program. But anyway, it's about that time of the year, in the middle of April. And although you won't be finding out about it in the establishment press, probably the spotlight will have something on it and we'll be able to tell you about it. Because even though establishment media representatives are at the Bilderberg meetings each year, you never see anything about it in the press.
You got something else? This is from Mother Earth News, Frank. Mm-hmm. We just mentioned the article dealing with oil company profits, and I guess most of us are going to wait until it gets to $1, $1.50 a gallon before we start growing corn in our backyards. But there is an alternative now. For less than $20, you can convert your car to run off 192 proof ethanol.
Methanol?
Ethanol.
Just like they use
ethanol
in the race cars?
Right, exactly. Oh. Just exactly like that. Mr. Scott Skylar, who is the Washington director for the National Center for Appropriate Technology, has converted his Rambler, 64 Rambler Classic, into a 100% alcohol-burning automobile, which is, of course, not just only cheaper in the long run, but it's also non-polluting. I think all he did, basically, was to bore out his carburetors, because alcohol takes up more room than gasoline. And he took a Ford, I hate to mention product names, but a Ford Motor Company windshield wiper washer motor. How about that? Windshield wiper washer motor, and uses that as a fuel injector. And does 0 to 60 in 15 seconds. And he said that Rambler's never run that fast in his life.
And it burns.
And it burns
cleanly.
It burns clean.
And it burns more coolly.
Right, and you can
you can make methanol out of anything.
Have anything.
Yeah,
right.
Anything that ferments. I've got a story here on ant pickers. You've heard of pea pickers. I've some uncles of mine were ant pickers, but that's not quite what Mr. Levine back in, I guess, New York. No, Inglewood, California has been doing. He's been in the ant farm business since 1956, and he's had some trouble getting ants. So what he did, he offered a penny an ant to anybody who'd bring an ant in. One guy, the first time he offered this, there were several city blocks of people lining up waiting to get in with boxes full of ants. One man came in and said he had 5,000 ants and wanted his $50. And when Mr. Levine asked if he really had that many, the guy got incensed. Well, count them yourself, he said. And he dumped the ants all over his desk. Well, of course, you've got to do things, Jack, as we know. You've got to come in with machinery, right? So they've come in with machinery for picking up ants. They got a lifetime contract with one family at an ant to pick ants for a penny an ant. And so these people, instead of wanting to do it by hand, they fashioned a vacuum machine out of with a car battery and all, an old auto heater and a piece of tubing. So they go around the area and they scoop up the ants, and they make between 400 and, well, 900 a week on a good day.
They dubbed it the anteater?
Yeah. They have to do something to poison the anteaters to keep them out of their area, I guess. Okay, now, talk about Marx for a while.
That'll be good for a change. Buddy, welcome to Alternative Views. The centerpiece of tonight's program is a discussion of Karl Marx and socialism today, a topic which you're probably not used to hearing on American television. And joining us on the panel tonight is Sveta Stahanovic, a visiting professor of the University of Texas Government Department, author of many books and articles on the subject of socialism, who will discuss his experience living in Yugoslavia, socialism in practice. But before we get to that, we're going to have Doug Kellner. Doug Kellner is going to talk about Karl Marx, and it's appropriate that we're going to discuss Karl Marx because his birthday is May 5th. He was born in, what, 1818, Doug?
In Trier, Germany.
Well, tell us a little bit about Karl Marx.
Well, Marx was a member of a middle-class family and lived in Trier, Germany, near the French border, and was very inspired by the ideals of the French Revolution. He believed in equality, liberty, and fraternity, and didn't see them realized in the society that he was living in, so that he thought it was necessary to have a revolution to have true equality, liberty, fraternity, to realize the ideals of the French Revolution.
What did he mean by revolution?
Well, this is an ambivalent situation given Karl Marx's legacy. He's often equated with believing that you needed a violent overthrow of capitalist society to create socialism. But, in fact, in 1848, he participated in a democratic revolution in Germany, and many times later in his life, he thought that parliamentary democracy would be an appropriate road for socialism, and indeed wrote that certain capitalist countries like Holland and America, and I think it was England, would be appropriate to have a more democratic road to socialism. And it's curious that there's a debate in the Marxian legacy as to what the proper road to socialism is.
Well, the word term socialism is thrown around a lot. What is socialism? What did Karl Marx mean by socialism?
Well, mainly it's a society where the people own the means of production and govern their labor, social, and political activity. I think the concept of self-management is a key concept here. Sveta, this is a main concept of Yugoslavian socialism. How would you define self-management socialism as a genuinely Marxist interpretation?
Well, probably the best way would be actually to compare it with what's going on in capitalism on the one hand, on the other hand in what I call statism. They themselves call socialism, but they are really not socialist countries, but statist countries in the sense that everything is statized, including
like in
the economy.
Soviet,
yeah, the paradigm case would be, of course, the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, obviously. Now, in both of those systems, workers work to get wages, in some cases very high wages in highly industrialized capitalist societies, do have trade unions. In the West, free trade unions, they have collective bargaining, can influence their working conditions, but they do not participate in the decision-making process at the workplace. So capitalism structurally or systemically speaking excludes democracy from the workplace. Now, of course, a similar situation, even worse in a sense, you have in statist societies in which the workers work and everything else is being decided at the factory level by the managers who are appointed by the state apparatus on which the working class has absolutely no influence.
So that a statist society is a society of party dictatorship.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is oligarchic statism I have in mind when I'm talking here. Now, self-management would essentially mean very radical democratization of the workplace. Now, you have several things connected then there. This is one, public ownership of the big means of production, but not for its own sake, but in order to be able to democratize the working place. You have to have public ownership of the big means of production. I'm not talking about small businesses, services, family farming, and things like that.
Isn't that part of the mythology about Karl Marx, that he opposed private property like personal possessions?
Yeah, sure. It's one of the schemas which people have learned somewhere about Karl Marx without having read Karl Marx.
Right. Excuse me, Sveta. Mm-hmm. I think just to clear this up for the people, when Karl Marx opposed private property, he wasn't talking about your right to own a TV set or a car. What he's talking about is the fact that the workers produce something and that they do not control or own, and that it is in turn sold for profit, which they have no part of.
Yeah, exactly. He was talking about free association of workers, of laborers. And so a self-management and self-government would mean public property of the big means of production, and then producers really participating in the decision-making process. That, of course, does not mean that you have to exclude expert managers who would manage factories on a day-to-day basis. I mean, but, of course, the question is who controls the managers.
In this sense, then, the Soviet Union is very un-Marxian, isn't it?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, let me intervene here. Some would argue that Marx's whole notion of the dictatorship of the proletariat laid the groundwork, at least him not clearing up what he meant by that, for this kind of centralized authority.
Now, it is true, of course, that he didn't go into details socialism. He didn't want to put down any blueprints for the future, as he would put it. Now, it is true that he used the word dictatorship of the proletariat. What he meant, essentially, was the temporary dictatorship of the overwhelming majority of the population over the dispossessed property minority in order to make it impossible for that small minority to come back to power. But that was supposed to be a transition period.
Exactly, it's a transition period.
That was supposed to be a transition period.
In which you'd have the withering away
which
of you, the state.
Yes,
not the violent opposition,
state,
but actually the withering away.
But we have, I think, to say today that it was a bad choice of the word, because really a more proper word, or shall we say a formula, would be, under such conditions, would be a democracy which is excluding certain minority rights, or rights for the minority, for the former property classes, and only temporarily. But it was a bad choice of the word, which made it possible then for some Bolsheviks, especially Stalinists, to abuse them.
I think it's also important to point out here that Marx, in his writing on the Paris Commune, described a model of socialism that had democracy built into it, that the workers would control all of the aspects of the society, that it would be free election, there would be rotating leadership, there would be no hierarchy,
sure,
there would be no real state apparatus, there wouldn't even be police or military, there would be the citizens armed in as police force, and there would be a citizens' guard. And it's curious that even Lenin, on the eve of the state of the Russian Revolution, in his book State and Revolution, appealed to the Paris Commune and this notion of democracy, which of course in the development of the Soviet Union was never allowed.
Yeah, it is really very strange that people who are criticizing Karl Marx usually point to Stalinism and say that is what he wanted. But of course he was not in the position of saying, even if he wanted, that he wanted Stalinism. The only example, empirical example, which he was pointing to was the Paris Commune. So why people don't analyze then the Paris Commune rather than Stalinism?
What is the Paris Commune, by the way?
Well, this is really the commune in Paris, which was encircled, of course, by the enemy forces, and people tried to establish their self-government. Yeah, 1871. They were trying to establish their self-government, to liberate themselves and to establish their self-government. Now, Marx thought that it was really not very realistic at that point, but once they moved ahead, he just welcomed that, and then later on, that is more important, theoretically analyzed what they were doing, and he was pointing to this, saying, this is really the workers' democracy, which I want under the name of socialism.
One factor that's pointed to it by American conservatives as a barrier, that which you have not mentioned, is that Marx had a very different notion of what human beings are or what they could become under a different kind of a social system, a different theory of human nature.
Species being.
Yeah, species being. Well, that.
Well, even species being. We don't have to get so technical.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it a notion that capitalism is founded on notions of the selfishness, the venality of people, that you have to appeal to their naked self-interest, that people are sort of competitive by nature, that Marx's notion of human beings was very much more being a communal and cooperative animal if given the material foundation to express that cooperation?
Well, this is a very complicated philosophical anthropological problem, as you know, but to oversimplify it, we may say nowadays that Karl Marx was a little bit too optimistic when it comes to human beings. It isn't that he wasn't aware that human beings have enormous potential for evil, for selfishness, for destructiveness. He was too great not to know that. The trouble was not on the factual level, as we philosophers would say. The trouble was his choice of categories. Now, when he talked about the positive side, he put it under the rubric of human essence. When he was talking about the bad side, he simply called it human existence. Obviously, he did emphasize the good side, and now we know better. But of course, it's easy 100 years later with the social sciences developments, with the history of the 20th century, which has been one of the bloodiest centuries in the recorded history.
I think it's important to point out, though, that Marx was not
for the sacrifice of individuality in some sort of a collectivist egalitarian society, but rather he wanted to develop many-sided individual human beings. He had sort of a Renaissance ideal of human nature.
Absolutely.
That human beings had many different needs and potentialities that weren't being adequately satisfied and fulfilled in a capitalist society that forced them to labor 8 to 12 hours a day doing the same repetitive job over and over.
In terrible working conditions,
you simply couldn't realize your humanity. And this, is, I think, is a very naturalistic notion of needs and potentialities that he wished to fulfill, and this was his notion of socialism. He wanted to provide the necessary goods and services to human beings that would allow them to fulfill their individuality and to develop their human nature, which is why these statist authoritarian communisms are a perversion of Marx's ideal of socialism that was dedicated to the liberation and development of individuals and human beings.
Sure. If anything, he was a personalist rather than a collectivist. I mean, you remember his famous formulation that the future society should be a society in which the freedom of each and every individual is preconditioned for the freedom of all. So his starting position really was a human individuality.
I think it should be pointed out here that Sveta's group in Yugoslavia, the Praxis group, is very important and influential in this humanistic interpretation of Marx and in advocating a humanistic concept of socialism. This is very important in the face of bureaucratic communism.
Sure. Sure. How far is Karl Marx really from the totalitarian, any totalitarian interpretation can be seen from the fact or in the fact that Marxist dissidents, Marxist critics are very dangerous in statist societies, and they are treating as being more dangerous than any other kinds of critics. Simply because, of course, I mean, they are criticizing the system in the name of Karl Marx, and Karl Marx is the ideologue of the system. He's been used as an ideologue of the system. And, of course, then, in a critical way, these critical humanistic Marxists are using Karl Marx in order to delegitimize the system, the statist system, and that is what they are.
Wasn't Marx supposed to have said, "I am not a Marxist"? At some time,
yes, he did say when he saw various interpretations.
Okay.
He said, "If these people are Marxists, I'm not a Marxist at all."
What are the features of a statist society? What are its institutional structures? What is the feature and mark of authoritarian communism that would distinguish it from genuine Marxian socialism?
Well, first of all, as I said, everything is statized. The state property of the economy. Politics is statized, education is statized, culture is statized, state, Stalinistic state, even tried to control private life. So you have an enormous state apparatus, really, parasiting on the society and trying to control the society. And of course, this is a party state, mm-hmm. meaning the Communist Party, in this case, a Stalinized Communist Party, is controlling the state.
What percentage of the population, by the way, in the Soviet Union is a member of the party?
5%.
Or couldn't be more than 5% or so. But even, I mean, when we are talking here about the party dictatorship, we have to be careful, because certainly not those 5% do control. I mean, even the party is controlled by its own apparatus, and really not the ordinary members that they control.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, in the case of Stalin, one person.
Yeah, sure. Well, ultimately, one person which was using even the secret police in order to try to control and purge the party apparatus, the state party apparatus. So one part of the statist system is this enormous state party apparatus. Now, parallel with it is that the masses of people are really, they don't have practically any important civic and human rights. They do not have control over that apparatus. On the contrary, they are being controlled by that apparatus. The working class, obviously, is not a ruling class, as their leading ruling ideology would tell us, but is an exploited class.
How do you explain, for that, if that's a deformation of Marxist theory, how do you explain the rise of bureaucratic communism or statism, as you referred to it?
Well, of course, there are many factors, historic factors, with regard or in connection with the Russian history, with the conditions. That was a sort of semi-feudal, semi-capitalist society, one of the Tsar's dictatorship. So the whole tradition was not ripe really for socialism.
Right, they went right from feudalism basically.
Exactly, practically. Exactly. This is one thing. The other thing, of course, were certain tendencies, centralistic and dictatorial tendencies within the Bolshevik Party. And, of course, the paradigm case would be the Stalinistic faction, which around 1928, 1929, 1930 got upper hand in the Bolshevik Party, took over the full control of the party, and then moved ahead with the statization, very bloody statization of the Soviet Union. Everything was statized, beginning with agriculture. That was a terroristic collectivization. We didn't have absolutely anything to do with the Marxist ideas on agriculture.
Is that you were actually talking about the murder of the Kulaks and the
Sure, millions of people were arrested and then killed and so on. Later on, we had purges even of the Bolshevik Party. Thousands and thousands of the Bolsheviks, including the leading Bolsheviks, were killed. That was also a bloody industrialization of the Soviet Union. And gradually, but rather quickly, a new class system was established in the Soviet Union, which I call statism. I think the name is proper, in which, of course, the working class is being exploited.
What makes Yugoslavia different, and how would you compare it to some of the other socialist countries that Americans could associate with, like Poland or Sweden, Finland?
First of all, of course, you have to know that unlike communist parties in Eastern Europe, the Yugoslavian Communist Party came to power on its own through the National Liberation Movement and the revolution between 1941 and 45. And it wasn't really much help by the Soviet Union. If there was any help, it really came from the Western powers, from Britain and the United States.
Fairly autonomous then in that respect.
Sure, it was an independent revolution, although, of course, Stalinism did have a big influence in 1930s and in 40s practically on all communist parties in the world, including the Yugoslavian Communist Party. And as you know, the Yugoslavian Communist Party then did break with Stalin in 1948. Before that, they tried somewhat to imitate the Soviet model, but they didn't want to move all the way, for instance, into a bloody terroristic collectivization of the land in Yugoslavia. So there was a sort of latent contradiction or tension in the Yugoslav Revolution from the very beginning. One is that it was One side of it was that it was an indigenous revolution. On the other hand, of course, Stalinistic dimension, the influence of Stalinism on the Yugoslavian Communist Party. They were bound to come into conflict one day. I'm not saying that out of necessity the outcome had to be what we see today, anti-Stalinism, but they were bound to come into conflict, and they came into conflict in 1948. Now, gradually then, the Yugoslavian Communist Party developed new ideas about the domestic internal system and also the foreign policy. The basis of the foreign policy, as you know, is the non-alignment. The ideological basis of the new domestic system is the idea of workers' councils or self-management at the workplace.
Could you explain this? I think this is one of the crucial contributions of Yugoslavian socialism, mm-hmm. this notion of workers' self-management. What form does it take?
Yeah.
Or what is the theory first and then the practice?
Yeah, formally it means the following. Let's stick to the economy for the time being. Let's say there is a factory. Now there's a general assembly of all people who work in the factory. They do meet, let's say, two times, three times per year. They make some certain basic, very basic decisions, and they do elect a body which is called Workers' Council, which is really not simply workers. I mean, there are workers on it. The majority of them are workers, but you have engineers, you have administrative staff, people like that. Now, this body, which is called Workers' Council, is supposed to be the highest decision-making body between two General Assembly meetings. Now, this is really then the highest body. They make some important decisions. They do hire managers. Managers come with their proposals to the Workers' Council's meetings. And then the Workers' Council's meetings make important decisions about investment, about the prices, and you have to keep in mind that the Yugoslavian system is a market system, unlike the East European and Russian systems. So publicly owned enterprises do compete with each other, but they so decide about wages, working conditions, and things like that. Now, obviously, I'm describing a formal structure. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it always works. that sometimes they are not manipulated by very skilled managers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You suddenly have this sort of latent tension between the workers' council and the expert managers who are supposed to manage the factory on a day-to-day basis. Sometimes, of course, they do manipulate workers' councils, but not always. Sometimes workers' councils are very, very powerful indeed.
There's a critique here in the United States that sort of sees the self-managed worker self-management as just being a more a subtle notion of sort of tension management, a way to sort of increase productivity to keep workers going, but actually only giving them the figment of participation, the figment of control.
Of course, it could be so. I mean, some very initial forms of workers' democracy at the workplace can be turned into some kind of simple integration, you know, in order to squeeze more productivity and more labor out of the workers, but not out of necessity. I mean, this is a these initial forms have an ambiguity to it, and they have a democratic potential. I mean, everything depends on the development. And obviously, you see, we are talking about human institutions and human forms. Now, nothing is automatically guaranteed. Everything depends on human beings and how they use it. Now, I don't want to make the wrong impression that the Yugoslavian global system is the system of worker self-management and self-government, because we are talking really about some initial forms, mm-hmm. and only at the workplace. Now, one of the basic problems of Yugoslavia is, of course, is democratization above that level. That means local level, the level of the workplace, and that would involve, of course, political democratization.
This sounds like a pragmatic Marxist model is actually what it sounds like. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, whatever works.
Yeah, it is. It certainly is. Some of the democratic dimensions in Karl Marx, basically the idea of factory to workers, also the idea of free associations of labor, some of his criticism of alienation and reification in capitalism. Nowadays we can add in statism too. Mm-hmm. He didn't envisage the possibility of moving into the direction of statism. But what is new there, revisionist, creative revisionist, is this idea of a new economy, a little bit of the market competition, of publicly owned economy. It's, if you know the Russian history or the history of the Russian revolution and the post-revolutionary developments in Russia, let me put it this way. This is Bukharinism on nth power. Okay, that was the idea of gradualism and of introducing market and of creating these material preconditions for real socialism. Because we are basically dealing with scarcity conditions, you see.
Isn't there a parallel relationship of political democracy, too, in Yugoslavia?
No, this is just the beginning. No,
I mean,
no,
I understand
really.
They're starting to experiment with this.
Yeah, there are certain experiments, but also there are setbacks. Of course, this is a single-party state, which is, of course, incomparably more liberal than anyone in Eastern Europe or in, of course, certainly in Russia. Now, let me put it this way. Although there are certain experiments, there are no extremely important achievements in terms of political democratization, except one, which I have to make. This is a very decentralized federal state. It's a state, six states plus two autonomous provinces, and the basic decisions, except when it comes to foreign policy, military, banking, the money, things like that, except for that, all other decisions are being taken at the level of the states, really, and of the autonomous province.
Well, you don't have a capitalist private ownership of
the big means of production. We do not have. We do have small businesses, privately owned. Yugoslav agriculture is 87% family farming, small family farming, with a ceiling, of course, on 10 to 20 hectares. Those are relatively small farms. These people are free. They produce, they sell their products on the market. So probably Westerners would say it's a sort of a mixed system, a public ownership of everything, big banks, factories, insurance companies and things like that, and small services, small businesses, agriculture.
I wonder if I can get you to address yourself to some of the economic issues that a lot of people out here are concerned with, things that seem to be indigenous in a capitalist society. I reported here on Turn of Views a couple of weeks ago that the average American hasn't taken home more than a dollar gain in income in the last 14 years. I mean, its relative inflation-adjusted income has stayed exactly the same the last 14 years. Unemployment, as reported, is only 6%, but if you break it down, black teenagers, it's 50 to 60%, black women, 30 to 50%, women alone, 33%, and a lot of people have simply quit looking for work, so they're not part of the statistics. business cycles have caused tremendous relocations of wealth, redistributions of wealth, and what have you in this economy. Are these things also prevalent in your economy, or do you notice a difference between, let's say, inflation and unemployment and business cycles in
now
your economy versus this country?
Now, to be honest, I mean, I have to say that the Yugoslavian system, being a market system, has unemployment, has...
What's the two choices we have? You kept saying a market system. What's the other choice? State allocation, state?
It's a rigidly state-planned, state-allocated system like one in the Soviet Union. Everything is decided at the center of the state, meaning the central state. Mm-hmm. Every single company gets assignments in terms of the products, what they have to produce, how to invest, how much, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So
what kind of
prices, wages, everything is set centrally. Now, the Yugoslavian system is a decentralized economic system. Now, we cannot have this decentralization without combining planning and market. Obviously.
Are people laid off in wholesale numbers like they are? Like a few years ago, the automobile industry was having some problems making profits, so they laid off about 50, 60,000 workers.
No, this is a publicly owned economy, and obviously, once you have these workers in workers' councils, they obviously are not going to lay themselves out,
right.
out and the other workers. No, unemployment is really unemployment of young generations, the newcomers. And mm-hmm. then these companies, run by the workers, by the workers' councils, are not in the position, because business is not very good at the moment, to take newcomers, new people. Mm-hmm. And this is the mainly... youth unemployed, which is a very big problem. We have, in addition to unemployment, we have quite a number of Yugoslavs working abroad with their passports. Now, this is a novelty with any communist system. Now, of course, when I'm saying here unemployment and that people have to go to work abroad, it really sounds more terrible than it is, let's say, in the Soviet Union and in the Eastern Europe. There you have a sort of full employment, but it's always a question of the price that you are going to pay for the full employment. In other words, they put two people at one place, cut their wages to 50% practically, and then have full unemployment, and mm-hmm. do not let anybody go abroad to work.
What about inflation?
Inflation is rather high in Yugoslavia. I don't know the figures. It's higher, obviously, than
5% there, and it's about 2% in the Soviet Union compared to...
You mean in Eastern Europe and in Russia?
Well... Right. In the Soviet Union, I've read where it's something about 3%, and Yugoslavia, it's something about 5 or 7%.
I think it is high at this moment.
But much lower than in the United Western
States.
Capital.
Is this something the government has direct control over in prices?
No. This is a market system. You see, the companies operate.
But you mentioned the big businesses.
Yeah. But even they operate on the market.
So do the workers go on strike?
Workers do go on strike.
The workers sabotage machinery?
No, they don't sabotage machinery, but they do go on strike occasionally. Although they have workers' councils, sometimes they feel so powerless that they have to strike against their own workers' councils.
Well, let me say,
you
are part of an autonomous movement within Yugoslavia in terms of being a critic. Are there autonomous movements of workers within Yugoslavia that oppose a state-managed system?
One cannot talk about any organized sort of critical movement here. There were some signs of it at the end of 1960s. But it is controlled now. So,
well,
you see, I
mentioned... Repression?
Oh, yes, practically. I mean, you remember I mentioned that the main problem for Yugoslavia nowadays is of course, political democratization.
You have a problem with censorship and...
There is no formal censorship. It doesn't mean that there is no control and no...
We don't have any formal censorship in this country either, but it's nonetheless routinely articulated.
Yeah. How would you compare now what has happened in China? They say they're Marxist. And Cuba, they say they're Marxist, and yet all these, once again, are quite different.
Yeah, first of all, I mean, in order that our comparison be fair, we have to say, actually, that Yugoslavia nowadays is almost a middle-developed country in terms of economy, whereas China is poor, of course, and Cuba is poor also, so we have to take that into account. Now, China is, of course, now in flux. They are changing their policies. I know that they are thinking now in terms of some of the Yugoslav experiments with a little bit of market competition, material stimuli, and also they are just thinking in terms of some initial forms of self-management. I know that they have the study groups in Yugoslavia studying the Yugoslav system and the problems.
But there's also tendencies towards statism and authoritarian communism in China, which it seems to me are being intensified in recent days.
Absolutely. Well, let me be quite clear. I mean, when I stand for democratic socialism, I wouldn't be able to point to any one country and say this is it. I could point only to some elements, some initial forms here and there, and not necessarily in the countries which call themselves socialist. For that matter, I think that there are more, if there are any, more elements of socialism, more promising elements in Scandinavian countries, than, let's say, in the Soviet Union, absolutely. So it's no geographic division.
Sveta, you're writing a book, are you not, on the democratization and humanization of socialism. Isn't it precisely at this point that your ideas become relevant? Do you want to say a few ideas about this humanization and democratization of work and the role of democracy and human rights in society as a means of democratizing and humanizing socialism?
Yeah, exactly. Well, in a few sentences, obviously. First of all, for me, socialism is linked essentially with democracy. There cannot be socialism without democracy. Even the word suggests this. Even the property cannot be a social property without democracy. It can be a statist property. The state controls it, but not the people, not the society. So, for me, socialism then is fully developed democracy, and that means democracy in all spheres of social life, including economy. These are structural limitations of capitalism I'm talking about now. Now, democracy in all spheres of social life, or universal democracy. Second, democracy should be as substantial and as less formal as possible. Substantial.
Real democracy.
Real democracy, meaning not simply equal rights, but equal possibilities for the people to use them. And of course, equal rights are important. But if you tell me I have the equal right to start a journal or a paper, equal in comparison with someone who has big money, well, we have equal rights, but we do not have real possibilities, equal real possibilities. So I'm talking about further development of equality. So universal democracy, as substantial democracy as possible, and as direct a democracy as possible, meaning wherever we have relatively small groups of people, workplaces, neighborhoods, things like that, people should run their business on their own. They don't have to elect anybody to represent them. Now, obviously, in complex societies, we have to have representative democracy, but something has to be done about alienation of the representatives from the people, so that democracy then in a developed socialism would not be simply shifting political elites, which are operating on a political market and selling their products and their candidates to the people, and then the role of the people is simply to elect these representatives and then go home, but rather to get people involved in the decision-making process on everyday basis. Now, with modern technology, very sophisticated modern technology, it is nowadays technically possible to consult people with referendum, for instance, on practically on regular basis. So it takes some political decision.
I'd like to ask you a question. Marx's work is so monumental, in which he combined just about everything that was known to man into a system. He'd be a philosopher, historian, economist, political scientist, everything. And it's to me a big impact is noted in a recent book by Robert Heilbronner, who is a noted economist, not a Marxist. Matter of fact, he's becoming a bit more conservative as the years go by, but he's a historian also. His latest book, I don't recall the name of it, but it's about the prospects for the human race and what we're going to live in. And he said that he was going to base this book and his analysis on the Marxian framework, on a Marxian basis, because that is the only system, the only framework, which really makes sense and is relevant and is complete enough to be able to handle the whole framework of analysis of human beings and their institutions.
Well, would you sum up the final the impact of Marx on the world?
Well,
25 words or less.
First of all, people who have read Marx cannot be but somewhat critical to capitalism to various degrees. I think people who have read Marx in a proper way cannot be but very critical toward the state system, which I have mentioned here. There are some important predictions of Karl Marx which have turned wrong, but it is very strange indeed that there are so many important predictions of his which turn right, which is very rare for social and political thinkers.
Particularly 100 years from 100 years.
Yes, 100 years he was talking in terms of industrialism, industrial progress, how nothing is going to stop industrialism moving on the global stage on Earth. And we see now that industrial societies are being built in every part of this globe. He talks also about the class structure. I don't think that without Karl Marx we can properly analyze the class structure nowadays.
He was the first sociologist.
In all kinds of societies, which, you see, I don't want to make the impression that it is simply enough to go to Karl Marx, take certain ideas and simply apply them. Mm-hmm. I mean, in his writings there are some very important insights which have to be taken up and have to be built upon. But they are so important insights that we cannot really deal with contemporary societies without Karl Marx. But when we talk about socialism, I do want to make quite clear that I do not think that a democratic socialist theory and practice can be simply built on Karl Marx. Socialist tradition is a broader one. It's not simply Marxist. There are various streams within the socialist movements, and there are important other, well, he is the most important one, but there are other important thinkers, you know, some anarchists, some anarcho-syndicalists, some guild socialists, some industrial democrats, some socialists, some social democrats. So the kind of Marxism which I am standing for tries to be quite open. See, and there are also important, shall we say, important institutional arrangements coming from the liberal, radical liberal tradition, which has to be taken up by socialists. For instance, division of power is very important, because if you don't divide it, you are going to create a monopoly of power, and then you have troubles.
So you have replaced the capitalists with the bureaucratic class.
Exactly. And that is why I have to add to that idea of self-management, self-government, publicly owned big means of production, also political pluralism.
Sveta, we want to thank you very much for your excellent presentation of your version of democratic and humanistic socialism. And I think Frank has the last word from Karl Marx.
Well, it's actually from C. Wright Mills in his book, The Marxists. Mills was not a Marxist, but he had...
Mills was a Texan from the University of Texas.
Yeah, he couldn't get...
He was fired.
Yeah.
But he has a great admiration for Marxism. He says, to come to grips with Marxism forces us to confront every public issue of the modern world, every great problem in social studies, every moral trouble encountered by men of sensibility today. And moreover, when we try to observe and to think within the Marxist point of view, we are bound to see these issues, problems, and troubles as inherently connected. We are forced to adopt an overall view of the world and of ourselves in relation to it. We're not supposed to know. As somebody else did some research, actually with a CBS correspondent, about the source of new... Remember when Carter talked about new foundations a while back in the State of Union message, if you were still awake by that time? Well, CBS correspondent searched until he finally found it. He found it in the Internationale, the old communist anthem. Poor Carter. We're talking about the record industry and the publishing industry. Well, the lion's share of $3.5 billion in profits went to just a small number of industry biggies now, going the same way as all the other businesses, more concentration. And the same sound trust that benefited from the sustained market growth in the past years, Columbia and Warner Brothers, the two monsters of the industry, have now been joined by a British and Dutch-owned firm called PolyGram. But they market most of their stuff in the United States. But all three are actually collections of once independent labels, but they're held together by common distribution, and management, and promotion. So what has happened in this industry as well as others, you find suddenly prices go, quality goes, and where all the creativity is stifled, the bottom line is what everybody looks at. And, well, you can tell that by listening and also when you open your pocketbook to pay for them. But you know the same thing is happening in the book publishing business. And in Business Society Review for Fall of 78, there's an article under the title, Some Big Boys Move Into the Book Publishing Business. It says that American authors are afraid that the ever-increasing concentration and conglomeration within the paperback publishing industry is leading to the suppression of books of literary and intellectual quality. The trend is now toward commercial rather than literary value, they say. Publishing is a highly successful industry, very profitable, and America has a tendency to be unwilling to tamper with economic, well, they say, success. That's debatable whether you want to call it success or not. I guess it depends on whose pocket the profits go into. But the quality of the books being bought and sold is questionable, according to the author. They say this contention is not surprising since the world of literature and ideas has always been on uneasy terms with the world of profit and spending. The Antitrust Division of the Justice Department has sued to force CBS, the owner of Holt, Reinhart, Winston, and Popular Library, to divest itself of its Fawcett Books ownership. But that's just a small little bit of the whole concentration that's going on there. Let's turn to our bedtime story. We always want to close with a nice, morbid, depressing bedtime story. The national search for a nuclear waste repository is likely to settle on the 570-square-mile Hanford Nuclear Reservation up there in the northwest. Well, their track record hadn't been too good, though. About 500,000 gallons of high-level waste have leaked into the ground of Hanford, including 115,000 gallons of caustic boiling waste from a storage tank during 50 days in 1973. And in the past 30 years, Hanford's management poured 31 million gallons of low-level weapons waste, containing at least 190 kilograms of plutonium, directly into the soil, at one point prompting fears of a runaway chain reaction. When the federal government admitted in 1977 that it couldn't account for about 4 tons of plutonium, enough for several hundred atomic bombs, more than a ton of it was believed to be missing from Hanford's inventories. The Hanford operators attributed the discrepancy to underestimating the amount of plutonium dumped into the ground with the waste. So, for many years, the Columbia River was the world's most radioactive waterway in the world, primarily because of the plutonium-producing reactors at Hanford. But after all but one of the 9 reactors shut down, the river's radioactivity levels diminished considerably, but the damage had already been done to the Columbia. Now the government wants to increase the plutonium production at Hanford for a new generation of nuclear weapons designed for first strike capabilities such as the Trident submarine and the cruise missile system. Well, be back with us next time on Alternative Views. Good night.